Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. Your panel this morning is to my right, Justice Ann Gardner. To my left, Justice Lee Gabriel. I'm Leanne Dofino. We have two cases set for oral submission on the 10:30 docket. Everything else is set for submission on briefs. I understand both sides are ready. All right, then if you'll call the first case, we'll get started.
The court will now call Prescription Health Network et al. Versus Toby Adams et al. And may it please the court, Mr. David Green to argue for the appellant and Ms. Mary Nix to argue for the appellee.
All right, David.
May it please the court. I am here on what some would consider to be a rather difficult journey, and that is to try to reverse an arbitration award. But I want to focus today on the statutory part.
Can you talk a little louder, please?
Yeah, I want to focus on the statutory part, the 4A, 10A4 portion of the federal statute with regard to the vacatur of an appeal. Of the arbitration award. This is a case where the AMC won 2 out of 10 of their points and claims, and we won 4 out of 6. But two of those were the big ones, and two of them, including the DTPA, the federal, the Florida portion of that, that's what has created all the damages in this case. Interestingly, PHN won its breach of contract suit on the franchise agreement, and AMC lost theirs. But they said, we cannot recover under that because you're going to lose later on down the road, if you read my award, on the DTPA in urging that it's Florida. So we're going to set that off against it. But this case, it's a tough burden, and there's been a lot of talk about manifest disregard. But what I want to argue is that manifest disregard, to the extent exists, it does exist in the statute. And here's a case where also it requires a reasoned award, which I discussed in my brief. And the reasoned award requires that there be some description, some analysis, some reasoning to support, in this case, which was submitted to them, the issue of the choice of law between the Texas Deceptive Trade Practices Act and the Florida Deceptive Trade Practices Act. And there isn't anything in the award. It's not just that they made a mistake and said one thing or the other. They actually completely omitted any discussion of that. And I'm going to explain to the court why I think that fits right into the Stolz-Nielsen case, in which they failed to pick any of the types of awards, the types of law that could apply, and just came up with their own policy. And so I think that's what we've got in this case. So we're going to look at the award itself. We don't need to go in into the nitty-gritty of all what went on in the arbitration. The award on its face, I believe, is shown to be improper under 4A as exceeding authority, or that the arbitrator's order so imperfectly executed that a mutual final and definite award upon the subject matter was not made. And first of all, with regard to manifest disregard, and there's a lot of discussion about whether it exists, and circuits are all in battles over whether or not it still exists or not. And frankly, the Hall Street case, which allegedly has erased all idea of manifest disregard, was set out just to a determination as to whether or not the parties could, by contract, change the review of the arbitration award. And the court came back and said, well, the exclusive review is under the statute, the 10A4 and Section 10 and 11. And that has been taken to mean by many courts that the manifest disregard doctrine has been taken away as a common law doctrine. But even Hall Street discusses and mentions that we, it says, we do not purport to say that they exclude more searching review based upon authority outside the statute as well. And of course, as you know from the briefing, following Hall Street came out the Stolt-Nielsen case. And in footnote 3 of the Stolt-Nielsen case, it talks about whether or not we do not decide whether manifest disregard survives Hall Street. But what they do say is animal feels characterizes that standard as requiring a showing the arbitrators knew of the relevant legal principle, appreciated it, and that it controlled the disputed issue, nonetheless willfully flouted the governing law by refusing to apply it. Now, in this case, it is clear that the arbitrator looked at the applicable law. In fact, it was argued in the pre-briefing, in the pre-hearing briefing by AMC, that the choice of law with regard to the deceptive trade, and they argued in the alternative, if we believe Texas law should apply because it is the place where the injury occurred, the Adams tried to start this business in Louisville in Texas. That's where the injury occurred, and that's what they've said. And there is a provision, of course, in the contract, the franchise agreement, that is specific just to contractual issues. And say anything about torts, it is limited to a determination of that contract. Now, what the arbitrators did, they said the tort claims said the franchise agreement will be interpreted and enforced in accordance with Florida law. But the tort claims asserted in AMC and their counterclaims and third-party claims are governed by Texas law in accordance with the most significant relationship test. And they have conceded in their pretrial, pre-hearing briefing that would, of course, be Texas law, which would be the Texas DTPA. So what is unusual, though, is when we get to that, and by the way, before I get to that, the idea that Citigroup markets versus Bacon is often cited as the big Fifth Circuit case that, oh, a manifest disregard is gone. However, what Citigroup did, and it was following Hall Street, the Supreme Court case I was talking about, but what it did and what it said was, I overruled the finding by the judge with regard to it on the common law, but I'm going to send it back and remand it to see whether or not there's any statutory grounds. Well, lo and behold, the judge enters an order, which is, I think it's submitted as one of my exhibits to my reply brief, submits an order that says, lo and behold, 4A of the statute, they have basically disregarded the law and applies basically the same kind of standard and finds that they have taken away the arbitration award and vacated pursuant to the statute. And that's the same situation we've got here. I'm not here to argue that it's common law. I'm right here. I'm going to focus on the 10A4 section of that statute because I think it's plenty. In fact, Stolt-Nielsen, the case that follows it up, as we know, talks about where they refuse to apply it. And interestingly, where they had two bodies of law, several bodies of law, but they failed to use any of those. In other words, as in the Stolt-Nielsen case, they said they came up with their own policy. And that's exactly what we've got in this case. We've got the Oxford...
Did the award find damages pursuant to the Florida Tort Claims Act, which was something that
not
you
the Tort
argued
Claims
as
Act.
An alternative?
No, I mean, it is the Florida Deceptive Trade Practices
okay,
Act.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
And in AMC's pre-hearing briefing, the reason I bring that up. Nobody's arguing that you can't have both the DTPA of Florida and the DTPA of Texas applying simultaneously. But that's really how the court treated it. If you go and look, as I pointed out in the brief, and it's Section 8, the Count 8, there is no discussion or analysis of the choice of law in there. In fact, that's like an either-or test. There is no such thing as an either-or test. which you get to find that the one that has the most liability is the winner. And that's how they did. This is, they simply have picked the winner.
Well, didn't you argue them in the alternative, though?
I'm sure that we may have as well.
Okay. And the difference is, under the Texas Act, you have to prove reliance, and under the Florida Act, you don't have to prove
reliance. That's correct.
So,
but nobody's,
isn't it just a proof issue?
No, it's not. Because, as I pointed out, the award itself has to have some reasoning behind it. And we're going to talk about the requirement of a reasoned opinion. At the beginning of the opinion, they talk about this is a reasoned award. And the cases that I've got in here that talk about that and talk about you cannot simply fill in the gaps for the arbitrator. And nobody argued that you can have both. You have to have one or the other.
And, well, they didn't find both. They just found Florida.
Well, he also talked about Texas. But if you, there is no, I think what she argued in her brief is that maybe they were thinking the contractual provision might apply to the Florida statute. However, they didn't say that. They didn't make any analysis whatsoever. And for it to be a reasoned award, they've got to provide some kind of basis for it. The Fifth Circuit talked about that in Rain C2 Carbon versus ConocoPhillips. In that case, where they had the market trying to come up with whether the market documents were correct for the pricing sheet, and they found that there was some basis for showing that the market price was okay. But they had to have some showing of that. And then in the Stagecoach Stage Stores case versus Gunnarsson, a case that came out just 3 or 4 months before my first brief was filed, and I wish I'd seen it then. I hadn't seen it. But that case comes out from the Houston First Court of Appeals in 2015, came out in October, that talks about the requirement and the requirements for a reasoned opinion. And you can't just have, you have to have a reasoning. You can't leave it blank. You have to have a reasoning for it. Now, as we know, there's three kinds of awards. There's a standard award where basically you don't have to have a reason. You just state the award. You have a reasoned award where you have to show some basis for the, by the way, some basis for the key issues. Well, the DTPA is a key issue. That's what this whole case turned on. Now, rather than coming up with a scheme or an argument for why the original choice of law, which they've already said, the torts would apply would be Texas. And the case that they talk about in the, in fact, the Fitzpatrick case with arbitrators talk about, is showing you don't need a reliance in Florida law, talks about the Deceptive Trade Practices Act being torts. So clearly, and I have some other cases that I did want to cite on that issue too, that are not in the brief, maybe I could submit to the court following, rather than take your time, but they basically say, ITCO case, that if you're looking at choice of law, you don't look at the contractual law provision of choice in law, because deceptive acts are completely separate from that issue. They're ex delicto versus ex contractu, and therefore you got to look at it where the injury occurred. And that's where we are in Texas. So because they had no basis for it under the Raines case and the Stage Door Gunnarsson case, and by the way, Stage Door case is an excellent discussion of the history, the requirements. For example, one of the requirements and necessities for having a reasoned award in the first place is to give some kind of reasons in order that the arbitrator will have some support, would show that he had exercised some critical analysis for his findings. There is no, in this case, he just punts. There's nothing in there about it. He puts both in there and treats them as if they were both could be applied at the same time. But that is no analysis whatsoever and would fail the test in Stage Stores. Now, there was some dissent in the case that said, well, because there's nothing in there about it, you ought to just imply that it's okay. And they said, no, no, not in a reasoned opinion. A reasoned award. Reasoned award requires, that's part of their requirement, requires that there be some basis for it. And in the Stage Doors case, they found that there wasn't because of a key issue that was cure. I forgot the defense, but there was a special defense that they needed to urge, and the judge didn't even deal with it. And they said that was key. In our case, this is key. The whole case turns on this. Case would reverse the entire damages award because the issues of attorney's fees, which is like $135,000 awarded to them, would be nullified because, you know, we clearly would have won and be the chief winner in this whole thing if this portion of it is reversed. And these cases would show that you can't just make stuff up. You can't pull it out of thin air. Stolt-Nielsen case. And in this case, they just didn't even pull anything out of thin air. They just ignored it. But we can also assume that they didn't just address it mentally, because otherwise they wouldn't have put...
Didn't just address it what?
Well, in other words, somebody might think, well, they were... You might imply that they...
I just didn't hear that word. Mentally. Okay.
Mentally. In other words, they might argue that, well, they might have in their own minds created a reason for it. But the fact that they put both in there, both Texas and Florida, talked about one not having any recovery, the other having recovery, and then just indicates that they weren't even making an analysis, which is a real problem.
Could we remand it for clarification?
Well, that's what they did in the Stage Doors case. I suppose that's possible, but I think that it would be better to vacate it because that's what it's 4A4. By the way, all of this discussion, I guess my time has run out.
Well, answer the question if you would, though, please.
I guess all of my, all of that discussion would be, what was the question I'm pulling?
Could we remand it for clarification?
The analysis in those cases, in Stage Doors and in the Raintree, was an exceeded the authority under 10A4, which provides for vacatur. And in cases where they have not ruled and they have not dealt with it, I think under the statute the proper ruling would be a vacatur. Thank you.
Other questions? All right. Thank you. Mary?
Your Honors, may it please the Court. Can you hear me well?
Yes.
Before I get into an argument, I think it is important to talk a bit about the facts of this case. I have lived with this case for about 3 years and was intimately involved in the reasons why various pleadings were made and involved in the hearing and in the post-briefing. Sacred in the franchise world, as you may know, is that a franchisor cannot make untruthful statements in financial performance representations. And that is what occurred here in a very unfortunate family situation. Lisa Adams, Lisa and Toby Adams are the appellees in this case, and their father, Ms. Adams' mother and father-in-law, Mrs. and Dr. Blackshear, are the owners of Prescription Health Network. Dr. Blackshear is the one who sold the franchise to the Adams and made what was proven to be false representations of financial performance, historical finances that were presented as accurate, that were proven to be false and with absolutely no basis in any truth whatsoever. And there were multiple of these representations made. The charts and the documents that were provided in Florida. The meetings occurred in Florida, and the franchisor and Dr. Blackshear are all residents of Florida. The franchise agreement called for Florida choice of law, and it called for 3 arbitrators on the panel who must have franchise law experience and for the franchise arbitration to occur in Florida. All of those things occurred, and there was a contested issue over whether or not Florida law applied as to various of the issues in front of the court. The panel made a decision that we did not win on the various tort claims that required reliance of fraud, fraudulent inducement, fraud based on a misinformation, and then a negligent misrepresentation. And the panel put those together in one reasoned award, one portion of the reasoned award on page 6, I believe. And then the panel discussed the contract issue separately, and then at the very end of the reasoned award, it discusses the Florida Deceptive Trade Practices Act claim and the Texas Deceptive Trade Practices Act claim, and compares them and makes the decision that the Florida Act is going to govern and that Dr. Blackshear and PHN were liable under the Florida Deceptive Trade Practices Act claim.
Do you agree that they stated that the Texas law would control the tort claims?
I do. They did say that. But here's what I think, Your Honor, and that is the contract claims clearly fall under franchise law. Those tort claims, they bunched together and made a decision related to those. And then they had the statutory claims, the Florida Act and the Texas Act. And those statutory claims are, yes, I think that if you're looking at the law in a very vacuum way of that paragraph, they do say tort claims are going to be under Texas law. But later, they carve out the Deceptive Trade Practices Act and analyze those separately. And there is a good reason for that. And one of,
say their reason? I mean, because that's what a reasoned award is about.
Well,
they,
Your Honor,
give their reason.
And here is another issue that I think is very important to raise at this point, and that is never in front of the arbitration panel, in the trial court, or in the appellant's original brief, has there ever been an issue raised as to whether or not this reasoned award was appropriate or inappropriate. The first time that this issue was raised in the reply brief, a 14-page analysis of an issue that is absolutely inappropriate to be in front of this court today. I had no opportunity, we have had no opportunity to brief, review, or discuss a reasoned award argument either in the trial court purview or in front of this court. And Texas rules of appellate procedure are absolutely clear that it is not appropriate for this court to hear those arguments unless they were raised in the trial court and there was a decision made, which absolutely did not happen. And then there is also case law that supports a very thing that I'm stating here, and that is that you cannot, as an appellant, raise a new issue in a reply brief and try to circumvent Texas Rule of Appellate Procedure 33. Now, in talking about whether or not this was a reasoned award, I believe that the Stage Stores case has been a bit misconstrued here. The Stage Stores case was related to an employment agreement where an executive left and did not, according to the appellant, provide a notice and an opportunity to cure. The executive stated that they were leaving for good reason and wanted to obtain the benefits of that agreement under the termination for good cause. I'm not saying that correctly. Leaving for a good reason, terminating his employment for a good reason. And then one of the defenses that the appellant had was that the executive had not provided notice and an opportunity to cure. And that argument was raised on multiple occasions, but it was not discussed at all, even at all, in the award. That was the only basis for overturning that award and sending it back to the lower courts. Not because it wasn't touched on enough, or there wasn't enough reasoning for it, or it was discussed but there wasn't enough reasoning. It wasn't even touched on, and we don't have that here. What we have here is a discussion on the two Deceptive Trade Practices Act cases and an argument that's trying to raise reasoned award to the level of facts of conclusions of law and findings of fact, which was not required here. And of course, the arbitrator panel did not do that. I'm sorry.
There was no discussion, though, in the award of a basis for using Florida law. No discussion.
There is no discussion of it. There isn't. And there's no requirement that there was. They had the authority to choose between those two laws, and they did. And there are reasons that make absolute perfect sense as to why they did. And according to Kraft versus Davis, the court should provide every reasonable presumption and indulge every reasonable presumption in order to uphold the arbitration award. And in this case, it would be a logical leap to say that they did not consider and make a decision related to either Florida or Texas, to the Texas laws. The Florida Deceptive Unfair Trade Practices Act is a Florida statute, and there is clear indication, as I addressed in our brief, that the Florida Deceptive Unfair Trade Practices Act was designed to govern Florida businesses. And there's another reason as well. In the franchise community, the Deceptive Trade Practices Acts are deemed and termed little FTC acts because the franchise community and their activities, as you know, are governed by the Federal Trade Commission. There is no private right of action if a franchise business violates the FTC. But the Deceptive Trade Practices Act of most states fill in that gap and allow a consumer, a franchisee, to file a private cause of action under a Deceptive Trade Practices Act claim in order to pursue a violation of the FTC. And that is exactly what we did here, and we did it in the alternative specifically because my belief that because a franchisor is a Florida business, that the Florida Deceptive Trade Practices Act was going to govern that franchised business.
But the way I read your brief,
yes,
on that issue was that the panel could have concluded this or that, your explanation. But aren't you, is that an example of applying a reasonable presumption, or is that permitted to read into the award reasons that just aren't there?
I think it's not only permitted, but it's required unless there is a findings of fact and conclusions of law, or unless the appellant can meet the burden of proof that the panel exceeded its authority. And in order to achieve that very high level of proof, there has to be something that is extremely outside the bounds of law. Here, their complaint is really that they chose the wrong law, and they would like the panel to substitute PHN's decision that Texas DTPA should apply, and that if it should apply, then it should apply in a certain way, rather than accepting that the arbitration panel selected the Florida law and applied it in the way that they felt was right during the hearing and the post-hearing briefing. And without having some way exceeding their powers and proving that they exceeded their powers, there's really nothing wrong with them making a decision between Florida and Texas statutes applying to the facts here, and there's nothing that I read in the case law that requires them to provide a detailed analysis of why they chose that law, other than what they did discuss, and that is the location of the franchisor, the discussion regarding what occurred, and all of the other things that led up to in their 21-page analysis of making their final ruling.
I have a question about the reference of the panel. It's on page 6 of their opinion award. At the very bottom, it bears mention that a franchisor is not prohibited from making disclaimers, blah, blah, blah. A franchisor cannot disclaim or require a prospective franchisee to waive reliance on representations made in the disclosure documents. And I was wondering, it's 16 Code of Federal Regulations, 436.9H. I was wondering if you could comment on the applicability of that provision to this case, or why they mentioned it, or how it comes into play.
Well, they mentioned that because when a financial performance representation is made in the course of selling a franchise, it is a requirement that, and this was an argument that I had made to the panel, that the franchisor cannot disclaim those representations and cannot require the franchisee to disclaim reliance on those representations.
Isn't that exactly the difference between the Florida and the Texas Deceptive Trade Practices Act?
It absolutely is. Yes, Your Honor, it is.
And wouldn't that prohibit waiver of reliance or disclaimer of reliance under the Florida Act as well?
Yes, it would.
But it doesn't, apparently, under their award.
I'm sorry?
But it doesn't apply under their award? I mean, they mentioned it, but I don't see how they applied it.
They do not apply it to the fraud and the fraudulent representation award, because the way I read their final award is that you cannot waive reliance under the fraud and those types of torts, but that the statutes, the Deceptive Trade Practices Act statutes, are what I deemed earlier, or termed earlier, the little FTC acts. And under the FTC, and specifically this provision here, you cannot, as a franchisor, enter into an agreement with a franchisee whereby they are disclaiming reliance on numbers that you provided and you assert to be accurate historical financial representations. And that's what we had here. And I think that that is the key to why we ultimately won with the arbitrator panel, is we had a very high burden to prove that those historical numbers were false. And it was not an easy thing to prove, as you can probably imagine. But once we proved that, and we proved that the Adams actually did rely on it in a significant way, it was clear that we were not going to win the fraud claims because the contract specifically stated that they waived reliance. But the DTPA claims do not do that. And I actually do not believe that the Texas DTPA would effectively require them to waive reliance on those FTC Act violations. I don't believe that that's the law in Texas. But it certainly is not the law in Florida, and it's not the law based on how this was interpreted by the panel. I think I'm getting close to the end.
Okay, sorry. Go ahead.
I wanted to address one final thing, and that was really on the Citigroup versus Bacon case that Mr. Green referenced. I think that case does illustrate what it takes to exceed authority in order to vacate an award. And if you review that case, which is tab C to his reply brief, it details all of the very arbitrary decisions that were made in that case. There was no basis in law, not a disagreement over the law. There was zero basis in law. There were nearly three pages of reasons why that case was deemed to be, the panel was deemed to have exceeded their powers in that case. And I do think that that case is a good example of why exceeding powers is such a high burden, and why courts have decided to require that arbitration decisions not be overturned unless an appellant can prove that the panel exceeded its authorities, because otherwise there would be too many ability to turn the appeal of an arbitration decision into a true appeal, which is not what it is meant to be. I appreciate your time.
Well, I was going to ask this, yes, the same question that I asked the appellant. Could we remand, ask them to clarify their decision?
I think that you can. I think the case law does give you that power to remand it to the arbitration panel and ask them to clarify. I do believe the case law does provide that.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you.
Is there a rebuttal?
First of all, I wanted to address the issue about the reasoned award in the reply brief. I will point out that the whole issue in this case from the beginning has been the same set of legal facts, and that is that they have failed to point out any reasoning for their award. And that, under Stolt-Nielsen, and pulling that stuff out of thin air, is a basis for exceeding the authority. And
did you argue that in the trial court on your motion to vacate? Did you make the same argument that you made in your reply brief to the trial court?
It is not in there. But
so what are we just supposed to disregard
the
trap rule?
No, it's a 4A argument. It's another reason that 10A4 is applicable.
But
it's for the same basis.
Issue in a reply brief.
It's the same issue.
Would you let me finish my question? But you can't argue something in a reply brief that you did not argue to the trial court and give the trial court, or in your original brief to this court, and give the trial court an opportunity to rule on. Do you disagree with that?
I don't disagree with the basis of that, but in all of these levels, we have argued the 4A argument, which is what this is. This is a further explanation of why 4A, 10A4, fails to or actually shows that there is exceeding the authority in this case, and it's for the same reasons, the reasons being that there is no legal reasoning given for their determination of choice of law. Thank you. And I would point out too that with regard to the Florida law, the basis of the court's decision is not that waivers would apply or not apply in Florida. It's that the statute itself does not have a requirement of reliance in the first place. So it has nothing to do with looking back at whether, you know, provisions are applicable or not in any contract. Simply looking at that statute and saying it doesn't require reliance in the first place. But it's a tort. The very case that says that is Fitzpatrick versus General Mills, which says a deceptive or unfair trade practice concept constitutes a somewhat unique tortious act. In this case, we don't just have an omission also of reasoning. We have specific reasoning at the beginning of the award that says torts will be handled by Texas law. And they go directly against that and violate that principle. And that violates Stolt-Nielsen. Whether or not we want to call it a reasoned opinion or not, it still violates the Supreme Court decision. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Well, we appreciate your coming here today. Your argument's been very helpful. Your case is submitted. You're free to go about your business, or you're free to stay and watch the next case if you would like to do that.